I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Boyada Mohammed Osman, a Sudanese-American advocate, public health professional, and poet with DMV roots. She completed her Master of Public Health at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School. She graduated from American University with a Bachelor's in Public Health. Her work experience spans from supporting young adults with disabilities, professional development, to health equity research. I previously read Boyada's work in Dr. Chuck's book, Eating Disorders Do Not Discriminate. And since then, I knew I needed to have her on the podcast. We speak all things eating disorder diagnosis, the impact of culture and religion, challenging internal thoughts, and navigating eating disorder recovery alongside advocacy for marginalised communities and her home country, Sudan. I just want to say that we do speak about eating disorders. We also speak about famine and war and conversations that may be difficult to individuals that have a connection to places like Sudan. Please take care, and I really hope that you enjoy this episode. Well, it is so lovely to have you on the podcast. This one has been a very exciting episode for me. It's been a long time coming since meeting you, but hearing you speak at Chuck's conference. So thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me, Hannah. I'm very excited. And
amazing. Did you want to introduce yourself for the listeners?
Yeah, definitely. So hi, everyone. My name is Bayazid. I am a Sudanese American. I came here as a refugee when I was a young child, in the early 2000s to the US. And currently I'm very passionate about social justice, health disparities. I had my master's from Hopkins, in public health. So a lot of my work just is tied into social justice. I'm also a social impact consultant as well. I have my own consulting firm.
Wow. That's awesome. I didn't know that.
Thanks.
That's so cool. So what do you do in your practice?
Oh, great question. So what I do, it's my practice is Bridges.co. And what we do is we help with PR, we help with communications, we help with grants, we help with anything really the client needs in order to make an impact in their community. And so far, my work has, like I noted, has focused on communities, organizations or high brands. Top brands that have been, or NGOs that have been focusing on Sudan. But I of course, don't limit myself to that work. So anything really that's here to make numbers through a different digital campaign work, I'd say a wide variety. There's some clients I've helped them with grants, some clients I help them make social media posts. It's really nice. The needs.
Yeah. That's what it sounds like, potentially. We're in a similar field then.
Oh, we definitely are.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. So really cool to know about what you get up to. And I think that like a lot of our conversation today will probably steer into that. Obviously, it's your passion. So I'm sure that we will kind of touch on that as we go talk through the podcast. But I wanted to speak to you today about your experience with an eating disorder. And I wondered if you wanted to, I hate doing this in podcasts. So I'm like, oh, can you just like, you know, give us a little TLDR about your eating disorder? And it feels, you know, really rude to do that because they do take over people's lives. But I just wondered what your experience had been.
Yeah, of course. And again, I feel super comfortable sharing with you because the intent of this is to educate and to bring awareness. It's different when somebody's like pointing me out in the middle of the room and like, tell me your story. You know, completely different intent. We're here to educate. We're here to do better and reflect. So happy to be here. I would say that my eating disorder has been with me for a couple of years. I want to say maybe 2019 is when I 2019 is when I want to say I officially got diagnosed. I began therapy, and I began therapy for my anxiety. So after receiving my diagnosis, after working through maybe months and months of therapy for that, managing my panic attacks, things like that, I started to briefly mention to my therapist, "Hey, by the way, I think I have some eating issues." And I thought it was just going to be a conversation in passing. And as all good therapists do, they open the box and they find all the goodies. And then that's really when I began my recovery, my journey, being able to, put words to what I was feeling and what I was doing. So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you don't mind me asking, what was it that you were diagnosed with?
Yeah, so initially I was actually diagnosed with ARFID, avoidant restrictive intake disorder. And then over time it transformed into eating disorder unspecified. So in my chart it says eating disorder unspecified. Or yeah. So that's why I had at the beginning a hard time accepting that I even had an eating disorder, because I was like, I've never heard of ARFID. I don't know what eating disorder unspecified means. Like all these different things, like that doesn't follow the traditional box of what the ones that we learned about in health class growing up. So that's why it took me a while to wrap my head around it, and even wrap my loved ones to wrap their head around it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know whether it's different in. Did you get diagnosed in the US? Sorry, I should probably ask. Yeah, I don't know whether it's different in the US, but I think we in the UK we used to have eating disorder unspecified, and now I think people are diagnosed with OSFED, so other specified. I don't know whether it's feeding or food. I think it's feeding and eating disorder. I wondered. From your perspective, because you said that you had a bit of a difficulty accepting that diagnosis, but how did the kind of terminology around that eating disorder unspecified make you feel?
That's a good question. So initially, I'll say that I lived with the ARFID diagnosis. Once I even accepted that one, I embraced it. I followed the pages. I tried to find myself a, understanding of what that meant and what it looked like for other people. But I didn't feel fully satisfied with that until recently. I want to say maybe like a year ago and some change. I was chatting with my therapist at the time, and she was like, "Oh no, actually, I changed it. Like it's eating disorder unspecified." So it kind of morphed and without even me knowing. So then I had to go through another moment of like, "Whoa, there's what do you mean? Specify it. Be specific. Where is it in the chart? I want to know in relation to everything else." Like, it's not, I do feel in my heart that in the next like 5, 10, 15, whatever amount of years, I think the specific thing I have is going to have a little bit more of a specified name. Maybe it already exists and just I haven't realized it. Maybe my therapist or my like the clinicians I worked with haven't been able to pin it out, but I just don't think I'm not satisfied fully with eating disorder unspecified. I cannot be the only one who has the thoughts I have. So I do think down the line, and that's the thing about this DSM and diagnoses in general. They were, this book was made a long time ago, and it's always like evolving to match the current times. And I do believe that it was white centric when it was initially made, and I do believe, in all health research, it's usually white men that are studied, and different cultural experiences and names and just genders and all these different things that differentiate us aren't really considered. So I do think the DSM and the language and just like the culture of it will catch up with the times. I know that's a huge jump, and I don't really have the huge, I'm not a psychologist anyway, I just have my master's in public health, but I do think the health field eventually will continue catching up with the people.
Yeah, I mean, I from the perspective that I sit, I don't think that
you know, you should kind of minimize your experience because you're not a psychologist. I think there's obviously things that having that qualification will allow you, but I think the lived experience perspective, you know, is so important. And I think about this a lot, and part of me does think, will we just shift in a direction of where someone's diagnosed with an eating disorder full stop? You know, my experience is similar to you. I was diagnosed with atypical anorexia, which fell under OSFED, but the term anorexia never resonated with me. It was never something that I thought that's what I struggle with. And the atypical, the use of that language made me feel like,
That's a typical way.
yeah, exactly. Like, for something that's born out of such perfectionistic tendencies, to be told you're atypical and not following the typical behaviors is
of a disorder. Yeah.
Yeah. Was my
it's a contradiction, really.
Yeah, literally. But I wanted to ask you a bit more about what made you feel as though you didn't necessarily align with the diagnosis that you were given, and the role of things like culture that you mentioned, that the role that they may have played on that.
Yeah, no, I clearly even my title of my chapter in Chuck's book was like, I don't remember it word for word, but it's just like, girl, what? Like, it was something along the lines, like, I remember her saying, oh, you sound like you have an eating disorder. I said, no, not me. I study public health. Like, I know public health. I've seen the movies. I've seen every single Netflix movie, documentary movie. I know what they say and what the standard stereotypical person. That's not me. What do you mean? Like, not me. I don't have the problems they have. I don't have the lived experiences they have. Not me. Like, so that was my initial reaction. It's because of just the representation that we have, and the how the conversation when it comes to eating disorders is so centric. And it's so centric, and I want to say it's limited. I do believe it's so important to discuss body image and body dysmorphia and that lived experience, but that's not what eating disorder as a full entails. Like, there's other elements, there's other reasons, there's other root causes. So I always just experienced it with that specific realm, and that wasn't something that I was necessarily just attached to in any way. So I just couldn't grasp that it was something bigger. So
yeah, I've got your book section up, and the title is Girl, You Sure? Ain't No Way. And
yes, honestly,
like, when you read that at the conference, I was like, oh my god, I'm hooked. Like, where are we going with this? Like, it's such a good title, and I think the way that you position that and the way that you say it, it's like, it is the sheer disbelief of what the hell are you talking about? Like, there
yeah,
is
like,
no
what?
Way.
Yeah, like, I'm sure you are familiar with the stereotypes as well. It's the stereotypes of an eating disorder. It's just individuals that, like, follow magazines, and they like to say that's the story, and maybe that's how it starts. I was just like, and I remember thinking, like, my family doesn't even have magazines in the house. Like, what do you mean? Like, this isn't, like, I thought it was a linear path, and it's like, health and wellness is never linear, like we think it is.
Yeah, and I think that that's such a big stigma, isn't it, in that, you know, eating disorders, particularly nowadays, are triggered by social media or images that we see in these idealized body types. And I don't know whether you've reflected on this in therapy, and you know, if you're okay to share, but if that wasn't for you, what you believe kind of, you know, maybe triggered the eating disorder, are there things that you think potentially could have, or is that something that you're like, I have no idea, it just kind of came about?
Oh, this is such a good question. I was kind of hoping you'd ask this question. Yeah, I didn't think I had an eating disorder because I don't experience body dysmorphia. I did not have any necessarily issues with how my body looked or felt. I was okay. I was happy with my body. The reason why my eating disorder developed was just from control. When I couldn't control the world around me, I controlled the body, my body. And what I felt is, this is the one thing that nobody would notice. This would only impact me. So it goes into self-harm. So it was like, for instance, like, I grew up, I had perfect grades. I, at the time, was actually working a lot with my Sudanese community. I was doing so much advocacy work. There was a revolution going on in Sudan at the time. I mean, I was killing it academically, professionally, socially. But it's like when I came home, it was just like just me and myself and nobody would notice. You know what I mean? I even had a thing where I didn't even miss any prayers. Like I was even praying, like because as a Muslim, you pray 5 times a day. So I was just like, yeah, I was doing my version of self-harm because I knew nobody would stop me. Nobody would notice. And I was making sure my relationship with God was good. I was praying. I went to work on time. I did my work. I was a great daughter. I was a great friend. I was a great this. So it was just like, this was my thing. And you don't necessarily at the beginning know that you're doing it. And I always felt this avoiding eating and things like that was my coping mechanism. And then once like she kind of pointed it out, I said, oh wow, this really is. So then you kind of fall deeper into it because you're trying to figure out why, and then you start working on recovery. So that's it. It's really just control. It's control
for me. It's interesting what you say about I can do this as a way of coping and nobody will notice. And I'm interested to, did people notice?
That's a good question. I'll tell you. That's a really good question. So as a Muslim woman, or the way I prefer to practice, I wear long sleeves. I don't really wear tight clothes. Who's going to notice? Especially when my body type, I'm still a little bit of a voluptuous woman. So who's going to notice? Especially when people didn't even realize that, you know, the eating disorder doesn't come with a size. Like, it's not stereotypical X amount of weight. So nobody was noticing for a very, very long time. And of course, I'd get the mom, the grandma, you need to eat more honey. But with mom running around and this person doing this, nobody had to know. Like, nobody really had to know. Nobody had time to know. Like, my loved ones, like, no. But I do know, that's why this is so important. There was one time when it was, like, very deep in it. My dad said to me, wow, you've lost a lot of weight. And that's when I was like, yeah. Because he doesn't comment on weight. And it wasn't out of, like, that's why we never comment on people's body weight. But the way he did it was, like, it was a place of love and concern. So it wasn't like, oh my God, what's wrong with you? Or, oh my God, go eat. It was like, hey, honey, like, are you okay? Like, I'm starting to notice you don't look the same. And that was also, and I was home, so my scarf was off. And like, I can obviously show body parts to my dad. So I probably had a t-shirt on and like regular pants and my hair was out. And he actually saw me for a second. But yeah, in general, who notices? Is my primary care doctor notice if I lose a lot of weight? No. Does my therapist notice? No. So, yeah, that's a really good question.
Yeah. Because, I mean, I think that it's quite common to think, you know, I'm going to start doing this and nobody will notice. And people do notice. But as you said, there's the, I guess, added factor of the fact that the clothes that you wear are baggy, and therefore, you know, you can almost kind of hide what's happening behind them. I wanted to ask, sort of, you know, I'm personally not myself within the Muslim community, and I wondered, is there an awareness of eating disorders? You know, is it something that people would openly talk about, or is it, you know, something that kind of people might start to recognize that you're struggling with but not want to have that or know how to have that conversation?
Oh, yes. We are a little behind on that one. We are really behind. We're pretty behind on that one. Because I just think our community is grappling with so many other things right now. We're a lot of, like, for those who are immigrants and also addition to Muslim, they're also just grappling with genocides that are happening overseas. They're grappling with wars, like my family is. So our plate just looks a little different right now. So that's why I don't even, like, shame them, per se, for not knowing. It's just, if you are thinking about survival and you're an immigrant in the U.S. or whatever country you went to, you're thinking about, how do I pay the bills? How do I learn this English word? When are my taxes due? You just have a different realm of issues that you are grappling with. So I don't even shame, like, I don't shame my mom and my dad for not understanding it, because they went to a whole other life challenge that I've never would experience in my life. So, like, I just believe when it's time and with the right people, like, we can slowly start having these conversations in a way that's loving and respectful. But I would say generally, I feel like our community is aware of depression, anxiety. Like, I'd say those are the ones that are the introductory ones. Maybe a little schizophrenia, like maybe the ones that you kind of see on media, perhaps. The ones that maybe bipolar, a little bit more niche, or not niche, a little more specific and have different ways of looking. So that one, that's my general answer. Because what, like, and the thing is about helping me with my eating, just talking to my eating disorder, my family's my eating disorder, is I had anxiety diagnosis first. So I had the big conversation, everyone, I'm starting therapy, blah, 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 blah. Everyone, I got diagnosed, da, 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 da. Then it was just like gradually, and then it was just like time for the finale. So that's, I do think that helped my journey. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I do think our community and our new generation, and because of social media, people are ready to learn. The youth are doing an incredible job. There are so many platforms that I personally follow that's like Islam and eating disorder. So it's like, there is, I don't want to say like there's no hope at all. It's just, I'm more so thinking about the older generation. They're still gonna, you know, take their time.
Yeah, and you know, I think that is. I don't necessarily think that's specific to the Muslim community. I think that there's still a lot of learning that needs to happen. I think, you know, our generation, our age, are so much more open about speaking about mental health, different things that people are experiencing. So it's fantastic to see that shift. And one thing that I wanted to ask you about, you kind of mentioned it there in terms of, like, you know, the things that are going on for your parents and, mm-hmm. you know, where their focuses are. And I know that you spoke about it in your book chapter in terms of things like, you know, survivor's guilt and food security. And I wondered if you could maybe talk to us about how, you know, how your thoughts have been around that. Because as somebody that maybe didn't understand what an eating disorder is, and this is not what I think, I, you know, I could sit here and be like, how the hell could you struggle with an eating disorder when, you know, people aren't eating right now and there's poverty and there's wars and this, that and the other?
Yeah.
But you and I both know that, like, eating disorders don't work like that. They're a mental health condition. But I wonder, for the people that maybe have that perspective, what your response would be.
Yeah, that's such a good question. Yeah, and it was honestly, for me, I can be more specific now. So for instance, right now in Sudan, there is a war going on. It's about to hit 2 years. It's the biggest, world's biggest displacement crisis right now. 12 million people are displaced, and we're hitting poverty. Like, not poverty, we're hitting famine in some locations. And with the USAID cuts right now, the federal government and Trump administration, like, all the cuts that are happening, 80% of kitchens are closed right now. So we're going to hit famine in Sudan. Like, very devastating. And that is something that I'm, like, working for, like, working to stop and things like that. And then in my, like, personal life, I'm trying to convince myself to eat a couple meals a day, or make sure I eat XYZ meal at this time. Like, I don't want to get specifics, but, like, I have specific goals for myself. So it's just, like, a weird dichotomy to be able to balance that. And the thing that has saved me through this experience is I don't talk to people about my experience if I know they would say something like that. I don't even give a chance for someone to say, like, something like that, because I'm already saying it to myself, and I don't need someone else to say it to me, because that would just throw me over edge. Like, that's just not good for me. So that's, like, my advice that I always tell people is, not everyone needs to know about your eating disorder. Even if they're your bestest friend in the world, you know, they're your mom. You think they're gonna say one thing that's not nice and not apologize for it? They don't need to know, because that's just too much of a risk and no interest. So I personally told my parents, my siblings, but I do know, like, you know, I love my grandma up and down and left and right, but I do know she just wouldn't understand. That's just not a conversation I need to have with my grandma. So that's really my advice. It's like, certain people are just, they are what they are, and you cannot change their relationship with them. And we can't. And so I would rather people focus on those who are receptive to hearing and to adapting and to learning. And not everybody is there. So when you say to me, what do I say to those people? I don't speak to those people. I don't need to speak to those people. They'll learn when they need to learn, and it's not my business if they don't learn.
I love that. I think that's so powerful to say, you know, just because I'm, you know, navigating it, it's not my job or my responsibility to educate people about that. I'm gonna switch the question, because okay, and I think it's fantastic as well, you know that speaking to your grandma, let's say, about it, the conversation's not going to be a productive one, and that is, you know, that is totally fine to not then have that conversation. But you said you don't need to have those conversations with other people because you're having it with yourself. How do you respond to when you make those comments?
It's therapy right now. It's therapy. It's what you're doing to me right now. Just kidding. I'm so silly. I'm sorry.
I like to dig, and I like it when people let me dig. So if it's
This is just really good. You're just good. You're good. Okay, you said, I'm so sorry, the question was, what do I say to myself? I think, I guess I just would go back to just like the general things I've learned in therapy of just acknowledging my sadness, my frustration, and not necessarily like arguing with myself, because sometimes you feel something and then you feel bad that you feel it. So maybe, let's say if I say that to myself, it's more so, hey, I'm hearing that you are thinking about the people in Sudan right now. That's so thoughtful of you for thinking about those who are in Sudan right now. Like talking to myself like my inner child. Like, wow, that's so great that you're thinking about them. You're very thoughtful. What can we do to support them? Do you think me not eating this meal right now is it like just talking myself, not arguing with myself and being like, well, it's an eating disorder, you couldn't, it's not how that, no, just be like, you know what, me thinking about them is not a bad thing, and two truths can exist at the same time. So let's focus on this meal that I have to take, for instance, or this meal that I'm eating right now, and then maybe in an hour let's go back to working on the fundraiser that I was working on. You know what I'm saying? Like, I just try not to punish myself for having these feelings, because it's just like, that's the whole issue. It's just like guilt and guilt and guilt and guilt, and then you're in a lone soul. And I'm happy to give another example that I'm going through right now. It's Ramadan, and I'm not fasting, and that is something I'm guilty about. Oh my God, all the Muslims are fasting. Why are you not fasting? Oh my God, do you not love God enough? Blah, 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 blah. You're supposed to fast. You've always done it. Why are you not doing it? Like, the inner critic in me is nagging me. So what I've been saying to myself, and my good friend has said it to me, was that those who are fasting, they're being obedient to God. They're being obedient to Allah. But he also says in the same religion, if you are not well, do not fast. So me not fasting is also being obedient. This is my way of being obedient and loving him and showing him respect and showing him, you know. So that's how I, like, navigate these inner critics in my head.
Now, I think it's thank you so much for sharing that. I distinctly remember for me, when I was in recovery and people would say, like, there's children starving in Africa and you won't eat your meal, and I just used to sit there and think, you know, I'm so sorry that they are, you know, they don't have access to food, but one, if I eat this meal or if I don't eat this meal, that is not going to impact that. But equally, putting that kind of connotation and guilt and pressure on yourself also doesn't help the situation. Mm-hmm. So making yourself feel worse about it is not actually supporting people in any which way. However, as you so nicely said, you know, right now what I'm focusing on is eating this meal, which then means that in an hour or so or whatever, I can go back to my advocacy work and I can then support people. But if I, you know, berate myself and don't eat right now, then I'm not going to be able to do that later, because I'm not going to be in the position that I need to be in to then do all of that work.
Yeah, you can't pour from an empty cup.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I'm really glad that you brought up Ramadan as well, because I mean, I've done a couple of podcasts over the years about Ramadan, and you know, the guests that I've had have echoed the same thing as you, in that the whole kind of point of it is being obedient. And actually, if you're not in that place where you can do it in a healthy way, then you are not doing, you know, you're not following it in the way that you, mm-hmm. that you should be, and that were what was intended. And I think from previous guests, and I don't know whether you've been the same, there's always been that sort of difficulty of, because of the lack of understanding or the lack of awareness of eating disorders, then, you know, being able to process that in your own thoughts, and, you know, speak to yourself in a way that is compassionate and supportive of your experience is hard. But then it also kind of goes back to what we were saying before, and, you know, the other voices that you then hear are other people, and, you know, people saying, well, why aren't you fasting? You know, you're supposed to be doing that for your religion, mm-hmm. and things like that. So yeah, thank you for sharing that as well, in terms of how you navigate that, because I can imagine for a lot of people, if recovery is something that they're going through, Ramadan is a difficult time.
Oh, because so difficult.
You need to look after yourself, but you also want to be doing things that, you know, align with your religion as well.
Yeah, no, it's definitely so difficult. In like the first year, I had to make the decision, and I made it with my psychiatrist. I made it with my psychologist, like my therapist at the time, and it was like a conversation we had like weeks up coming up, and we just came to the decision. It was my first time not doing it, and it was just a completely different experience. And like, I clearly remember the conversation like I had with my mom, like, hey mom, this year I won't be able to fast. And she was just like, oh, what, like, you can't do it, like, you're not gonna be able to do it. And I was just like, well, I'm just too good at it. That's what I said to her. That's not what Ramadan is. It's not avoiding and restricting intake. That's not what this is about. So will I be doing it for the right sake? So I need to find something else in during this month. And that's okay, because there's other alternatives. Like, for instance, like me not fasting, like the Islamic alternative is that you give money each day to someone in need, and that's an amount of a meal. So it's like you're feeding someone else. So it's like there is alternatives. Like, you know, the religion isn't necessarily supposed to be hard. It is hard at times. But, you know, it's for good, and it's for cleansing, and it's for, you know, discipline, and it's for compassion and so many other things. So there's other things someone can fast from. You know, I have other goals that I'm holding myself accountable to this month. So that's my experience. But that's like that's me now 3-4 years of not fasting. So that's me saying it really nice. But yeah, every year, the first few days of Ramadan, even just 2 weeks ago, Ramadan started. Day one, guilt. Let me do it anyway. But so-and-so did it, and so-and-so is still sick. And then I just have to have that conversation with the right friends, the right loved ones. And they're like, you hear you out. So I feel like that's my, if anyone gets a message from this, is you got to find your community, you got to find your people. And someone saying really hurtful things to you, and they're triggering you, and they're not that. So keep looking, keep digging, even if they're strangers online.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, I think the power of community is incredible, yeah. Isn't it? And, you know, I think that one thing that people can experience when they're experiencing an eating disorder is that element of isolation and loneliness and feeling like you are the only person experiencing it. And actually, I think once you then start talking to people, you notice that, you know, other people have, you know, not necessarily the same, but similar experiences. Mm-hmm. And I can imagine, you know, I don't know whether you've experienced this yourself, but I know for me, when I was really sick with my eating disorder, there was almost like this kind of contradictory about it, because I felt so out of control with what was happening in the world, and I couldn't help, and that was what panicked me and worried me and brought up so much anxiety. But then actually the eating disorder took me to a place where not that none of it mattered, but I was so consumed by the eating disorder that I didn't really have the capacity to think about it. So actually the way that I had tried to control things to then be able to, you know, put back more into the whole world, I actually felt so numb to it all that I was even more reserved from it than what I was to start with. And I don't know whether you had any experiences like that in terms of the overwhelm of the eating disorder.
I haven't even thought about, sounds like it kind of numbed you. Just for me, I wouldn't say numbness wasn't my goal. I felt high when I hit a certain level of avoiding eating, like a really hunger. It's really just hunger is what it was. I hit a certain level and I would feel like a peak. And I'd feel light, I'd feel productive, I feel just like adrenaline rush, and then I just would be so productive and get stuff done. And I didn't necessarily, like I said, know at the beginning that it was tied to hunger. It was just more so like, I could do this. And then what ends up happening is then, of course, you end up having a crash. So it's like, there's like a peak high for me of like not eating. And then it eventually hits a boom, headache, can't go to sleep, belly hurts. And then it ends up me ending the night with drinking a cup of milk or like something to just like quickly alleviate the pain. So that was what I was kind of aiming to have. And yeah, it was like, it's a physical and it's an emotional sensation I had in my body that made me feel more productive. I could save the world. I could do this. And I would, like, I have like clear memories of like kind of also a poet. So during the time of the revolution, I wrote a lot of poetry, and like that was what my, like the vehicle I used in order to educate people about everything going on in Sudan. So I would remember, like, I'd have to finish a poem before I'd go eat. Like, I wouldn't let myself eat until I finished this writing the poem. So like little things like that, was I was using food as a reward for things like that. And I would put the food in front of me, and then I'd see how long I can go without eating it. And nobody would know I'm doing it. It's just in my head that made me feel good that I did it. Or it'd be like, I'd finish the thing, but like the food's right there and I can like, can't like touch it until I do it. So it's just like little things that made me feel control while my country was burning down overseas. Like, so that was burning down. Like, if you really, like, things were burning down, there was a huge revolution, peaceful protesters were getting murdered. I was posting every second of the day. I had family members that were detained, being tortured in prison. Like, I hadn't, like, just a lot of, like, trauma just, like, being thrown at me. And I even remember, like, Facebook, Twitter, WhatsApp, you just would refresh your feed, see what's going on. See, and it's, like, every time you do it, you realize, like, that could be your next family member, the next person that you see on the timeline. Because my cousins, everybody was going out to the protest. Everybody was, like, involved. So any second, you just, like, mentally prepare yourself. And it's my friends, family members were getting murdered. So it was just like little things. My uncle got shot. Like, it was just continuously. So yeah, me putting that plate of food on the side and not eating it until I do XYZ. Yeah, that was the control I had for the day. Like, and in comparison to what they're going through, I didn't think I was doing nothing wrong. I didn't think I was harming myself. You know, I had the survival skill. I was the lucky one that came to the U.S. and I get to tweet about the protest in my nice little comfy AC house while people are dying for a cause that that I got lucked out from. And, you know, like if I was in Sudan, I'd be there. But no, I'm here. Lucky me. So, yeah, I think I just wanted to be the most productive I could be. And I felt that was the way I could be the most productive. So I would say, yeah. That was my goal.
And how did you shift that perspective to say to yourself, okay, I know that that is going on right now and I want to help as much as I can, but actually what I'm doing to myself here is not helping? Because I think it's so tricky, isn't it, when you almost were showing yourself that not eating was, you know, you got that high. You kind of pushed yourself to new things.
Yeah. Because it was working. God forbid I say it was working. Like, it was working. But the thing is, I think that what did it for me, it was working until it stopped working. Like, there's a certain amount of damage that you could do to your body before your body goes, girl, like, I'm done with you. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I was hitting walls. Like, this, like, it was small things. Like, at night, you can't sleep. Your belly hurts. Your head hurts. Then it's, like, panic attacks. And, like, it becomes things that really impact your day-to-day. So once it started, like, I it's so difficult for me to drive. Driving would make me so anxious. So then from that point, that was like the conversation triggered and me. So there was a conversation about me getting on like medications. And then I get on medications. And then with medications, it was helping me with my mood. So it was helping me with my appetite. And the thing is too, the way my psychologist or my therapist, it's probably accurate, but even if it wasn't accurate, she got me good. She'd say, you have to take your medicine, but in order to take your medicine, you have to eat with it. Like, you sneaky little. So boom, that was my one meal, at least the one meal locked in, guaranteed. So it was like little things like that is once you start like prioritizing, because you really have no choice, because it's like, how do I drive? How do I get to work? How do I make money? Well, take your medicine. But if you want to take your medicine, you got to eat. So it was just like, you got no choice but to start taking care of yourself. I like you said, I was losing, like we mentioned earlier, I was losing a lot of weight. So my, you know, my loved ones started pointing it out. So it was things that was like, I was physically not feeling good anymore. And I really just kind of had no choice but to work the other way around, because it wasn't sustainable anymore. And, you know, once you realize that you work in the community or in advocacy, you realize what you're doing is, it has to be sustainable, because, you know, even after the revolution ends in Sudan, or even when this war ends in Sudan, there's still going to be work to be done. And if you're still burnt out from the last thing, like, we got to keep going. So I think that's what pulled me out. It's just my passion, my dedication to the cause, because that was what kind of caused me to have the eating disorder, but then that's what kind of helped me get out of it at the same time. So I guess that's my advice for folks, is they feel like maybe they're stuck in their eating disorder or whatever mental illness. It's just like there's more to you than just that, and once you find the thing that's more to you, you'll put that on the forefront, and then everything else will come secondary, and then it will all connect, and then you would be able to like bring yourself up all the way. I hit my burnt out stage with advocacy organizing. I started working twice a week with my therapist. I had food logs. That's what I was doing, and every week I'd come and show her the food log. So it's like what you ate, what time you ate it, and what you felt when you ate it. And just note, so then I started noticing my patterns, what were my triggers, and then from there, just methods of like, okay, well, how do we work through that trigger? How do we work through it in a healthy way? So that's when once I started noticing my patterns, my coping mechanisms, taking my medication more consistently, then I now know what I need to do. Now, I don't necessarily do it all the time, because that's not, for me, I'm not that point of my recovery, unfortunately. But I can say I'm on the recovery, because I'm like, I'm aware. I know I have the language, I have the tools, I have my little toolbox here. Sometimes I don't go in there, but I know it's there. So yeah, that's where I'd say I'm at right now. And what pulled me out was just kind of really having no other choice. Yeah.
I think, yeah, so much of what you said, I highly resonate with. And I don't want to say that in order to recover, you have to hit rock bottom. But I think sometimes it is about realizing the impact that it's having on your life and the things that are being affected, and actually thinking the eating disorder isn't my priority anymore. These are the things that are being affected are. And I need to shift something here so that they're prioritized rather than the eating disorder. And I think it's interesting what you said about the toolbox as well, because I think for so long when I was in recovery, I thought, oh, recovery looks like this, or, you know, there was a specific image I had of recovery. And actually, now that I'm in my own recovery, I'm kind of thinking, well, it looks different for everybody. And actually, sometimes there will be days where I super lean into those eating disorder behaviors and I don't even realize I'm doing it. And then all of a sudden I think, oh my God, oops, we've gone back there. And then you have those coping mechanisms in that toolbox. And so I, you know, personally don't believe that there'll ever be a day where I don't need that toolbox. Or that, you know, I might not slip back into things. But I think, as you, you know, so nicely put it, it's the time for me in between the behavior and the realization of what I'm doing. Before, it might have been months, whereas now it's potentially hours, maybe even minutes. Some days it might be days, but it's a lot quicker than what it used to be.
That's such a good point. I would give you an example. It was the first day of Ramadan 2 weeks ago. So what happened is, like, I woke up in the morning, I haven't eaten yet, and the back of my head, I'm like, maybe I should just fast today. So then I start having this conversation, I'm like, maybe I should just fast today. Yeah, if I fast today, then I'll be able to, you know, like, do that thing, and then work on that thing, and then work on that thing, and then do that thing. And then by the time I've done all that, then I can eat, because then it's, and I was like, girl, that's not what that's about. I immediately stopped right there. I was like, girl, can't fast today. You saw it on your face when I was literally brushing my teeth in the bathroom. I was like, yeah, I'm gonna finally get to work. I'm playing. And I was just like, you're not fasting. So that's so funny that you caught it up on that, because I remember calling one of my best friends immediately after, and I was just like, yeah, so I tried to do the thing, and then she was like, oh, okay. And I was like, you can't do the thing. So in that moment, it was like seconds. I was like, I know what I just did. And that's, you know what I mean? Other than, like, and back in the day, I wouldn't have realized it, maybe until like 12 o'clock at night when my head is banging and not realizing why it's banging.
And that to me is, that's what recovery is. It's the realizations, the awareness, as you said, you know, that awareness of, oh, I think this feels a bit familiar. I know what's happening here. And then, you know, as you said, having those coping mechanisms, whether it's checking in with yourself, having a word with yourself, having a word with friends, you know, doing whatever you need to do in that moment. Honestly, it has been such a lovely conversation with you. Thank you so, so much for sharing, you know, your personal journey and, you know, for the conversation, because I think it's such an important one to be having, and I think so many people will resonate. Where can people go if they want to hear more from you? I know you do a lot of your poetry and a lot of your advocacy work. So if people want to follow along, where can they go?
Definitely. So my website is yourbayazir.com, yourbayazir.com. But I do a lot of my work on Instagram, so it's yourbay. So your Baya. And also my other social media platforms are under similar names. But Instagram is my go-to.
Awesome. Amazing. Well, I'll put that all in that in the show notes for everybody. But thank you so, so much. It's honestly been such a pleasure to chat to you. So I really appreciate it.
Thank you. This is so much fun. I really appreciate it, Hannah. Thanks for having me.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.